There is a halfway mark between the known and unknown. A middle ground or chamber where divine wisdom and truth reside. In this middle chamber, we will explore and expose the ruling paradigms of social engineering, mind control, government conspiracies, and cover-ups. Join us as we navigate the territories and boundaries of natural law and the ancient principles of the sacred feminine and divine masculine. Examine and consider alternative energy systems, holistic healing arts, and wild soulful living to train our awareness in a most novel and abstract manner to view reality from an entirely new perspective. Welcome to the Middle Chamber.
Welcome to another episode of the Middle Chamber. I am Frater X, and as always, I'm joined by my wife and co-conspirator, Mater X. How are you today, Mater X?
I'm doing great. Sun is shining. It's not too hot, and I'm not working right now.
Are you ready to shake the pillars of nonconformity, as it were?
To the very foundations.
Okay, great. Well, I wanted to mention a few things before we get started. I'm really excited about this podcast. And as many of you listening may already know, we are currently raising funds for the Middle Chamber Summer Tour. That's right, Familia X is venturing forth once more into the great wide open. And this is no small task, actually, financially. But we do have several public events planned. The first being the Extraordinary Technology and Science Conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which is at the end of July. Look for the links on our internet locations, our Facebook page, which is Frater X, Mater X, like first name, last name. The blog, FraterX.blogspot.com. And then, of course, the website, MiddleChamberFX.wordpress.com. You all are familiar with that. You can also follow us on Twitter at TMC369. And next, we'll be traveling to San Diego for the Paranoia Con, August 2nd and 3rd, which we're really excited about. I'll be one of the presenters at this event. And from there, we go north to the Olympia Sync Summit in Olympia, Washington, August 8th and 9th. Now, a word about finances here for your information, dear listeners. Mater X and I are working class wage slaves with four children. So basically what that means is we live off of what we can earn. And, you know, my wife, she rises each morning at the crack of dawn to work till midday, where we then change the guard, so to speak, and she takes over with the kids in the household so that I can do a bit of work until my work, a bit of work on my own, researching and writing and preparing podcasts and other media. And then I go off to my own work shift, which is from dinner time to about 11 p.m. each night, then returning home to spend what little time we have left together until we start over all over again the next day. This is our lives. Some of you may be familiar with this kind of regimen or routine. So we just barely make it each month, literally squeaking by, either breaking even or with less than $20 left in our coffers for any other added expenses to all the other cost of living that we pay for. And, you know, I mean, to be clear here, we are extremely frugal. We have no extra expenses, no extravagances. We do not, we don't go out to eat. No movies, no frivolous purchases whatsoever. We don't even have cell phones, you know. We don't live on credit cards either. So, I mean, we basically live by what we earn. We don't go into debt to live. And, you know, that causes trouble for us. Oftentimes people are surprised that we don't use credit cards to pay for everything. Yeah, this does make it hard. So to plan for a summer tour seems almost imaginable from this perspective. And we don't know right now where all the money will be coming from. So with this in mind, we're asking anyone that could help to support our plan to be at these events this summer. Please, if you can help, you can give to our PayPal account under Mater X's email, which is materx369@gmail.com. That's Mater X, M-A-T-E-R-X, the numbers 369 at gmail.com. And we're also going to have our own little Indiegogo fundraiser here very shortly to help finance this tour. We'll keep you posted, and we'll, you know, we'd like to thank you ahead of time for any help that you can give us. So in just a moment, we're going to welcome our extra special guest for this episode, this chat today. And speaking of chats, this show's chat room can be found at middlechamberchat.chatango.com, or go to our website for the link or the Facebook page. And we have seen an increase in the chat room attendance once again these past couple weeks, and we're really excited. We're glad that people are coming back in. And so on, if it's Saturday night right now and it's after 9 p.m. Central Time, join us in the chat room where we review this podcast each week together and field any questions and comments from the listeners, so we can share in that experience with the listeners instead of being distracted by the, you know, producing the podcast. Okay, now, I also have some breaking news for the Middle Chamber audience. It looks like the new media network that we've been trying to organize and launch for over a year now is finally really coming together. Conspiracy HQ will launch next month, and the Middle Chamber is proud to join the ranks of the cutting-edge, innovative media providers that have gathered under this banner. So stay tuned for more info and check back with our website and various media pages to keep informed and updated on all the amazing things that will be coming straight from the digital underground to your media device, all the more ways to listen to the paradigm shift. Now, our guests for this podcast almost need no introduction. They have both made names for themselves in the so-called truther sphere with some of the most original, groundbreaking, and thought-provoking material available today. What makes them unique is the caliber of their research and the strength of their message. Now, these are not mere dabblers in the current trends or memes out there. These gentlemen are not simply looking for a soapbox to capitalize on the conspiracy theory frenzy that seems to be manifesting in our social narrative today. These men are pioneers. They truly are frontiersmen at the cutting edge of our understanding of the postmodern world we find ourselves in. You know, they've volunteered to go out into the darkness, to journey far from the warm campfires of human so-called certainty or preconceptions in search of truth, no matter the psychic or social costs. And I, for one, applaud their efforts. I find them both to be good-intentioned and passionate individuals, motivated by the desire to share the conclusions they have reached after the most extensive and exhaustive study and research. I encourage anyone listening who is not familiar with their work to review the numerous materials that they have produced together and on their own. And I have titled this chat, CIA and the Counterculture. Now, this is based on the material that they've already produced. And I wanted to have these gentlemen on the show because I personally, you know, the topic of military intelligence agencies' involvement in the manufacturing of, well, any facet of our culture, I believe, is hugely important, especially if many facets of our culture. And the patterns and implications from the material and research that we will review during this podcast impacts us all, whether you may realize it or not. So, you know, I hope that you do realize this by the end of the show, basically. Now, based on the reactions to the subject matter that we will discuss today that I've already had from people I have already discussed this with, this seems to be highly volatile stuff. Now, what are we talking about here? Now, we have stated in our mission statement here in the Middle Chamber, that we are here to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted, that no idol or cow is too sacred to challenge or reconsider, no belief or conviction immune to scrutiny. We are interested in truth and certainty, as well as justice and moral virtue. And now, we never claim to have cornered the market on these ideals to be certain, or to have anything like perfect clarity or understanding of these topics and facts that we examine. We are here to learn, to gain understanding, and to fearlessly face any challenges to what we may think that we know. It has been my persistent and prevailing experience that most convictions and beliefs held by the majority of the crowd, as the case may be, is often grossly inaccurate or outright false. The truth is often unpleasant. And as the saying goes, you know, the truth hurts. And emotion is a key aspect to all of this. We will examine emotion as an integral tool of thought control, the how and why it is so effective. we don't mean to any real offense with the material we will review in this podcast, yet we do expect and anticipate it, and we understand it, though not for the same reasons as some of you might think. We only ask that you keep an open mind while listening to this. We are here to consider all perspectives and draw our conclusions from what we learn, from honest, fearless, and rational examinations. Now, several years ago, I discovered both researchers on the show today quite independent of each other. Jan Ervin's entheogenic studies, as well as his promotion of the Trivium, first caught my eye, along with some of the most insightful interviews with many of the most important researchers, theorists, and media producers in so many relevant fields and topics. His websites, especially GnosticMedia.com, that's G-N-O-S-T-I-C Media.com, are pioneering efforts in our current so-called truther movement. Jan and I have done some podcasts in the past, most notably examining his secret history on the magic mushroom, which is now available in the Middle Chamber G Drive. So if you email me at freighterxfreezone@gmail.com, I can invite you to access this database where you can check out that podcast and any others. Joseph Atwill was first brought to my attention from a Red Ice interview a few years back promoting his then new release, Caesar's Messiah. We had him on the show after reviewing the DVD of the same name that he helped to produce with filmmakers who took his research in a slightly different, though just as relevant, perspective. Mr. Atwill's innovative analysis and insightful identification of the specific typography he has offered, compelling proof is contained within the gospel account, is, I believe, revolutionary. Now, these two mavericks came together last year and produced the provocative article titled Manufacturing the Deadhead, which was published on GnosticMedia.com, and you can still find it there. Now, last month, they released a video which I really think takes their research to the next level, titled Psychedelic Intelligence, which will be the main focus of our discussion, but it won't be the only thing we talk about. Now, this video was also released by Gnostic Media and can be found as well on GnosticMedia.com. Now, the union of these two titans of research is not surprising to me, as I see many key elements within their individual materials that clearly align and overlay. What Jan has consistently presented as the overarching theme of government intelligence being deeply involved in many aspects of and key individuals in the so-called counterculture in America. Post-World War II, especially, but with roots to the designs and designers tracing back even further. And Joseph's theory of the Roman-controlled opposition, if you will, inventing not only Christianity, but quite possibly rabbinical Judaism as well, in effect usurping the existing counterculture in Rome at that time. These two new state incarnations replacing an existing legitimate counterculture, probably. Following the destruction of Jerusalem and the Temple of Solomon and Herod, the spiritual center of religious life and focus for the Jewish people up until that time, the only religious systems left standing when the smoke cleared were the ones allowed by the state. Not unlike the New Age political correctness, which evolved out of the counterculture and is now embedded in our own government bureaucracy, so too did the counterculture movement of Rome evolve into a state religion, which, well, eventually conquered the world. And of course, as we know, Christianity ushered in the infamous Dark Age in Europe. As we fear, the New Age ideals centered within our counterculture in America might be interpreted as bringing about a new Dark Age, which quite possibly is already being foisted upon us here in the West, at least. Now, are we being led into neo-feudalism, masked as a native archaic revival? Well, this is a good question. It really is easy for me to believe that knowledge has been co-opted, wisdom usurped, and replaced with counterfeit education and reality. I have reached these conclusions from my own research, which I call the Secret War on Human Consciousness. We must focus more on results here than intentions, whether real or imagined. And one glaring result of the so-called hippie movement being its permanent grafting upon the anti-war movement of the 60s, which only served to further alienate and polarize the nation around the Vietnam farce, forever morphing the entire anti-war movement, which at the time, mostly clean-cut, educated, morally upright, all-American kids, into the dirty, hairy, unpatriotic freaks of the movement with their debauched lifestyles, drug use, and free love leading to crime and disease, mostly, and just all-around antisocial behavior. So we continue with this saga, which we could title Everything You Think You Know Is Wrong. And this is the terrible and glaring fact that all this research has led us to. In my own Secret War on Human Consciousness, which I have elaborated on an extremely personal level in the forthcoming volume, The Secret War Inside Freemasonry, once again, it is certainty and truth that we seek, no matter how difficult or inconvenient it may be. We choose to look where others dare not. And with this podcast, we will surely shake the pillars and, you know, challenge those sacred cows of our society. I must admit now that I am biased because I was born to baby boomer parents. The adult generation for me has always been baby boomers, the predecessors of the so-called X generation that Mater and X and I belong to, which is one of the reasons why I chose the moniker Freighter X, by the way. I grew up listening to the music and the rhetoric of those who considered themselves part of the movement, regaling the glory days and attempting to convince me that they had accomplished anything, you know. Usually the boldest claim was that they'd stop the war. Well, in fact, we didn't officially pull out of Vietnam until 1975. And of course, the claim of victories for the cause of civil rights and freedom. Really? I ask you, all listening right now, are we truly better off because of the counterculture movement of the 60s and all the supposed victories for civil rights in this country? Environmental protection in the last 50 years? Personal liberties? The Americans' people, their right to peacefully assemble and redress their government's leaders with their grievances. How about corporate fascism and war as a business model? Illegal wars based on lies and misinformation, for that matter. Any real decreases of this here in our world today? What seems to have been created in the 60s was an American pseudo-aristocracy in our own popular culture, which more than ever sees fit to behave above and beyond the laws which oppress everyday citizens. While criminals like OJ or Ben Bernanke walk free for committing murder, robbing the U.S. Treasury, while petty crimes and drug charges get mandatory sentences, a crack dealer on the streets of Boston gets 10 years for a $10 piece of cocaine imported by the CIA, most probably. Intelligence agencies at the root of this, the most heinous violations of human rights and dignities imaginable, are glorified in our media. CIA, NSA, people are walking around with NSA hats on and CIA hats on, just normal citizens. And the American populace is lulled to complicity through fear and clever gadgets. Better living through broadband computer technology, right? Most emphatically wrong. More and more in the news, we hear stories of people being arrested for growing their own food and forming cooperatives with their neighbors, or being thrown off their land or forced to destroy their own homes because they choose to live off the grid, to homestead, to live self-reliantly. More and more police pigs out there gun down people, unarmed in cold blood, children, old people, innocent citizens abused by glorified thugs and psychopaths, while everyone worships NCIS, Law and Order, and CSI, and the endless stream of law enforcement clone TV shows. Modern medicine offering unnecessary and unsafe treatments, destroying people's lives and their families' lives, while the populace is conditioned to unquestioningly trust their doctors and medicine through one doctor drama or comedy after another on TV. What of the movement now? Where's the outrage? Where's the protest from the baby boomers? Heavily sedated and lulled to sleep, that's where. And it didn't happen overnight. So now, dear listeners, I caution you all. Don't attack the messengers here for pointing out that the emperor wears no clothes and the movement quite possibly was government issued. It's time for an honest appraisal and reckoning. Ask yourself, what lasting effect or result did the counterculture movement of the 60s really have? And more importantly, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll lifestyle, how has that really turned out for anyone who indulged it? At the core of this research, we will review a series of theories which must be considered theories, which redefined what we think of our government, our media, and the very foundation and fabric of our society. The most importantly, free will and independent critical thinking. How has it been affected here? We must be willing to accept honestly and responsibly what we find out if there is to be any hope for true freedom and liberty here and now and in the future. And I must admit, I remain optimistic because I have a vested interest in the future. We have 4 children preparing to inherit whatever world that we have helped make for them. What we discover reviewing many works, especially Propaganda by Edward Bernays, which we will, I'm sure, it will come up in this conversation, is the universal application of techniques to create opinion and beliefs in the mass of society. And this is, in fact, a collaborative effort enlisting all phases of our social structure to meet the necessary needs of the archetypes of our reality. The mind of humanity is malleable, and our governments know this and exploit this continuously and universally. Nothing is sacred. Nothing is exempt from being employed for the cause of thought control. And with that, I want to welcome our guests, and I want to thank them for indulging my long-windedness, and to say welcome Jan Irvin, welcome Joseph Atwill.
Hey, Frater. Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you here. Thank you both for being available for this. Now, you know, just to jump right into it, I wanted to give you both a chance to just talk about, for the listeners, your motivating factors. I mean, I think I kind of, you know, pointed to it, but I wanted to give you a chance to speak for yourselves and just kind of throw out there what you, you know, first of all, applause for this latest video, Psychedelic Intelligence. Excellent work, guys, really. And that article you wrote last year, Manufacturing the Deadhead, I emphatically urge everyone to go and read this article and review this video. But I wanted to ask you both, just what was the motivating factor? How'd you get to this place, and what you hope people will get from it?
Why don't you take that one first, Jan?
All right. Well, you know, what got me started in all of this, and it's kind of interesting because Joe and I kind of have a similar origin in our areas of research and our early interests, but I started off as the publisher of John Allegro's book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. From 2004 to 2009, I worked with his daughter, and then in 2009, we republished his book. And in 2008, I published a book called The Holy Mushroom, where I was going through all of the attacks against Allegro's work, checking his claims, following up his footnotes and his citations, and then going out and getting each original citation and then lining them all up and checking every one. And as far as his entheogen research or psychedelic research, every single citation checked out, but yet he had been attacked for 40 years for all of these supposed errors. So then this forced the attention in another direction towards R. Gordon Wasson, the so-called discoverer of magic mushrooms. And, you know, because it was Wasson who launched all of these attacks against Allegro in the press, in the London Times, and he basically continued all of these attacks for 16 years. And so around 2007, it hit on me that Gordon Wasson was an agent, and then that made me start questioning his background. And so I just slowly started gathering information, contradictions and things that didn't quite fit. And then, you know, maybe 3-4 years ago, I started contacting university archives and filing FOIA requests with the CIA and FBI on these on Gordon Wasson, these types of people, to see what I could find in that regard. And then this began to tell a whole different story that basically what we discovered was that Wasson was a chairman for the Council on Foreign Relations. And mind you, this is the so-called discoverer of magic mushrooms. Along with Aldous Huxley, he is credited as the one of the two basically primary people who launched the psychedelic movement. And then on further research, we also discovered that Gordon Wasson headed MKUltra Subproject 58 for the CIA, which became the famous May 13, 1957 Life magazine article, Seeking the Magic Mushroom, that announced magic mushrooms to the world. And then we also discovered that behind the scenes, he had been working with guys like Aldous Huxley, who we've since shown was also CIA. And just this this week I discovered a citation. I'd actually found it maybe a year or two ago and forgotten about it. But that Wasson was also working with Captain Al Hubbard, or Captain Trips, the famous Johnny Appleseed of LSD, who we also know was OSS and CIA, and he's the one that spread LSD all over North America. So, you know, these slow discoveries and leading up last year to the manufacturing the Deadhead article with Joe, you know, all of these things just sort of snowballed together, and I was actually at Joe's house one day, and he and I were sitting there talking, maybe even filming, and it just occurred to me in the middle of our conversation that, you know, oh, hey, they're creating a new dark age, and then we began to find all of this evidence that that was exactly the case. And then the video, the psychedelic intelligence, that was basically, you know, Joe's in it a lot, but that one we actually, Sarah and I basically just took a whole bunch of interviews on this that we had done and put together, primarily featuring Joe and Jay, and then trying to get it into a compressed format to reach as many people as we can in the shortest amount of time.
Right. My trajectory was different, of course, because I had a different vein of scholarship I was engaged in. I was looking at the origins of Christianity, and specifically I was studying the Gospels themselves, and I was developing the thesis that the Gospels had been produced by the Roman Caesar family, the Flavians, and I had written this book, Caesar's Messiah, which led me to the second book that basically takes up, well, how did it become the state religion? Why did Christianity end up as the state religion? And in that work, I realized eventually that Christianity was used by Constantine as mind control. Basically, it was just promising the Christian serf, which is a fancy word for slave, a worker's paradise that would exist, you know, following his death, if he obeyed the Pope, which was simply another name for Caesar. So that research, which ended up in my latest book, which is called, oddly enough, Shakespeare's Secret Messiah, because it goes so much into the works of Shakespeare, showing their relationship to this vein of literature that the Caesars produce, which we see as the New Testament. But in doing that work, I was confronted with modern Christianity, and I was often asked about it. And because I could see Christianity had been used in the original feudal system as mind control, I was very curious about what is seen as neo-Christianity, And this would be the modern kind of esoteric version of Christianity that's promoted by Oprah and really has its origin in the work, A Course on Miracles. And so I started reading A Course on Miracles and was amazed that it, you know, was very obvious to me, just a kind of a mind-numbing, mind control apparatus. I could see it just coming right from the same genre that the Caesars had developed. And so I started to study the authors and realized, came across the fact that they both worked for this odd organization called MKUltra, which I had never heard of before. And when I looked at the author's background, and I could see why they had been hired, it was because they were basically psychologists who were studying crowd control. So this seemed odd to me, and I started looking at MKUltra in a more general sense. Jan and I then started to correspond, and at some point, as Jan said, we actually met, and in the discussions, I could just see there was a tremendous amount of overlap between what I was trying to uncover, what Jan was doing, and particularly in terms of MKUltra. And Jan is the one who pointed out to me that there is an actual primary document showing that Gordon Wasson, the discoverer of so-called discoverer of magic mushrooms, which was really in the Life magazine article, the introduction of the psychedelic drugs to the American community, that Gordon Wasson's project had been an MKUltra project. Now, this was simply too much data and too close a proximity. It's the statistical concept of cluster, which is simply that when you have unusual things all happening side by side, there has to be some kind of causality for it. You just, you know, if you have a paragraph with 100 numbers in it and they all happen to be three, this isn't circumstance or some force driving it. And so when Jan showed me that document, that began the effort that ended up in the Manufacturing the Deadhead, in which we did research showing that basically the entire counterculture had been organized by the government based probably originally on science that Gregory Bateson had developed that had to do with a superior population controlling an inferior population through causing the inferior population to experience a native revival. And incidentally, those aren't my terms. Those are Gregory Bateson's terms. Superior population, inferior population, native revival. So this this appeared to be what was occurring in the counterculture. And when you suddenly have the Sunset Strip and characters like David Crosby appear dressed as though they are a member of the Lewis and Clark expedition and promoting drugs, then it's really a pretty clear, you know, picture that they're painting. You're just in the government's attempt to debase the culture. And there, you know, as you go further, you can see sad and but obvious things which show the kind of sophistication they have. If you ever look at the cover of the Life magazine that presented psychedelic drugs to America,
May 13, 1957.
Right. You see, they have a description of these fantastic visions. In other words, it has a very tempting kind of description of what Wasson was claiming happened when he took psychedelic mushrooms. But then the next article, the line underneath it has three words, teenage allowances, right? So this isn't circumstance. It's you're not being paranoid. It's real. They are essentially trying to plant ideas about, you know, what is going to happen with this drug, that the teenagers will be allowed to take it. And so, you know, when you get into the stuff that Jan points out in The Brain and in his latest video, I mean, it's a very, very sad, terrifying and, you know, miserable journey. But it's one that citizens have to take, because this is, in fact, shows that there is some organization inside the government that is not operating in the interest of the citizens and has tremendous control.
Wow. I also wanted to advise all the listeners out there to go to Gnostic Media right now, if you're listening to this podcast, and open up the Brain database that you'll find right at the top toolbar. It says Brain. Click that and open it up and refer to it while we're discussing all this, because you'll get a better illustrative view of the people, the players, and the documents that we're referring to.
But now, let me just jump in right here, Frater, because you know, Joe and I have both already mentioned Life magazine. Now, Life magazine, you'll find, is extremely key. You know, you'll be reading all of these books on MKUltra, and there's Life, and there's Life, and there's Time, and there's Time, and there's Life. And, you know, wherever some weird interview in some obscure place was going on, there's Life, or there's Time. And, of course, Time Life was run by originally by Henry Luce. Henry Luce was a friend of Gordon Wasson's at the Century Club. And in fact, Gordon Wasson's boss had actually funded Time Life magazines. And so we always see Time Life right in the middle of, you know, promoting Woodstock, promoting the Los Angeles counterculture. And as Dave McGowan has shown in his new book that just came out in April, the entire hippie scene actually started in L.A. and not San Francisco. And it's really interesting. San Francisco sort of happened simultaneously, but with a little bit of lag there. But it's really interesting how they've gotten people to focus on the idea that it all started in San Francisco and not in several places simultaneously, because then if it starts in several places simultaneously, then it actually forces you to have a different line of questioning about it, about the whole event. But we have it happening in L.A., and Joe had just mentioned David Crosby. Now, I've also discussed David Crosby a lot in my interviews with Dave McGowan on the show, and he goes into Crosby's background as well. Now, all of this stuff happened in L.A. around Laurel Canyon. All of the murders were on Laurel Canyon, and of course, they never want to talk about the murders, but, you know, Charles Manson, all of this stuff, that was all on Laurel Canyon. And so right down the street from Laurel Canyon, and in fact, on Laurel Canyon, there's one of the streets that crosses it, is called Mulholland Drive. And down Mulholland Drive from Laurel Canyon was a guy by the name of Aldous Huxley. Now, Aldous Huxley, and, you know, and of course, you know, for plausible deniability, they always put out that Huxley warned of have been one of these bad guys. But Huxley was actually one of the CIA's architects for MKUltra, and he's actually living right down the street from Laurel Canyon while this is going on. Now, to add one more piece to this puzzle, Huxley's granddaughter, and it was probably, you know, I'm not sure which granddaughter it was. He had a couple of different granddaughters there, but his granddaughter, I'm just trying to see if I can find her name here. It might have been Tessa, something like that. But one of his granddaughters worked with Vito Polakis, who was Vito and the Freaks that started the, you know, the hippie dress and dance and all of that in the Laurel Canyon scene. So we have a direct connection between Huxley, one of the head key architects of MKUltra who worked with Wasson. Oh, and by the way, you know, Gregory Bateson's work, that feeds directly into Huxley's. So Gregory Bateson takes the Native Revivalism, and then Huxley takes the drugs, and they basically crash them together. And so then that becomes this new psychedelic movement, and they're promoting sort of a, Dr. Rima Lebo put it? Anyway, they try to recreate the Hindu caste system in the West, and they want to sell the ideas of the Hindu caste, the ancient Hindu control system, onto the American public as spirituality. So Huxley's right in there, Gregory Bateson's right in there, and all of this stuff sort of centers and comes out of Los Angeles and then out of San Francisco, and then spreads out from there.
You know, when we think about, you've mentioned Los Angeles and San Francisco, I think it's important for people when they're thinking about what we're talking about here is to try to imagine an embryonic California, an embryonic L.A., not the giant megapolis we know today that houses Hollywood and everything connected to that, but a different city that was founded by a lot of individuals with very questionable motives. And there was a lot of paramilitary and vigilante organizations that roamed the countryside around there, basically suppressing the native populations, the Mexicans and other people that lived in those areas, to make way for this progressive new white culture that was being transplanted there. And there's all kinds of implications to that. But the important thing is to realize that there was already, a whole scaffolding, a whole framework being established, I think, that made it the perfect center for the operations that you have uncovered and the things that you have reviewed in your material. But I think it's also important for us to kind of, in order to lay the groundwork for us, to sort of turn the clock back a little to maybe post-World War I America and talk about the key individual who constantly comes up, and that is Edward Bernays and his work and research, especially propaganda. So would you like to just kind of hit that topic a little bit, guys?
Joe, why don't you go?
Sure. Well, Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud and had an active correspondence throughout his life with his uncle, and so certainly would have had access to the theories and science that Sigmund was producing. And while Freud, of course, is best known for his thesis on psychoanalysis, he in fact was a group theorist, social theorist, who had connections into what's known as the Tavistock Institute, which was developing these sort of understanding of how to control society. this was the one of the critical questions they were trying to answer. And Bernays enters the scene at an incredibly young age, 23, I believe. He developed a play, helped through the use of propaganda to get a play that would never have been permitted otherwise onto the Broadway, and having had it produced, called Damaged Goods, which was this highly sexualized play, discussed venereal disease and sexuality in general. And this was essentially what can be called as edgy. The term is almost always used nefariously, incidentally. But so it's an edgy kind of an event that moves culture in this direction.
That play, Joe, it also had a mimed masturbation too, right? They had
The masturbation comes from his next production. Bernays was just a one-man wrecking crew. He produced a Polish ballet star named Nijinsky. He brought him to the United States and was the producer of his tour. And he essentially ran interference, because wherever the guy went, they tried to shut the show down. And Nijinsky would mime masturbation. He then, developed feminism and tobacco use. He worked for the tobacco company and used young women as advertisements to show people what a great hip thing it was to be smoking cigarettes. He then went on and introduced fluoridation. I mean, this guy was just an absolute arch criminal type. He was hired by Wilson to essentially convince the population that World War I was a good idea, right? He and this one other individual, who was a Bohemian Grove member, they ran the propaganda device. They developed, for example, the picture of a gorilla in a German outfit holding a blonde-haired woman. This would be the way that the war could be best understood by the American population. So this, this is the thing about Bernays that struck me was that if you go forward 50 years and you see the sexual displays, you see free love, you see drug use, you have all of these things having been the original direction that was heading, that was essentially preparing culture to accept these ideas, had begun 50 years earlier with Bernays. And just because of the collection of things that Bernays was involved with, it can't be circumstantial, or it would just be incredible if it was. This looks like a very deliberate effort to bring about what would eventually be the archaic revival. And if you look then with the connection between Bernays and Gregory Bateson. Now, Bateson was the OSS anthropologist. So again, you have this social science that the government is involved with. You have with Bernays, you have him hired by Wilson to do the War is Good department during World War I. With Bateson, you have him being essentially an employee of the OSS and apparently in charge of the anthropology that they were developing. And with Bateson, you have, as with Gordon Wasson, you have original Freedom of Information Act material, which shows that he was developing the techniques for enslaving, right? That he actually was giving to the OSS this advice in terms of how to enslave populations. So now when you go forward another 15 years, you find Bateson emerging in Palo Alto, in the hospital that MKUltra is devising their experiments, trying to determine more precisely what the drug can do for some reason. No one really knows what they were actually doing. But you also have all of these other individuals. You have Ken Kesey. You have Robert Hunter of the Grateful Dead. You have the drug manufacturer, Stanley Ausley. All of these individuals are in the same location, right? They're all essentially in the Palo Alto area, in communication with Bateson. And then further south, you know, you have this LA scene with the military intelligence community developing, you know, the hippie movement and rock and roll. Well, you know, at a certain point, you just have too many dots to too close together for it to be circumstance. You know, I know lots of people, because I lived through the 60s, I know lots of people who took drugs, who listened to rock and roll music. I know people who are in bands. I don't know anyone that whose father was a, you know, a member of intelligence. These are very unusual things. I don't know anyone who was an employee of MK Ultra. So when you look at the collection of individuals who made up the avant-garde of the counterculture, and every one of them fits into this category, then it's just completely transparent. You're dealing with an organized movement that the government is hoisting onto culture. The motivation is the one that is described in the Freedom of Information Act letter that Bateson wrote, which basically enables a culture to be, it's easier to enslave them when they embrace their past. They're not jealous of the technology of the superior individuals. They don't try to participate in the political activity. You know, they seem to get status by doing their ancient activity. That's why you have the, you know, the fringe jackets, the buckskin jackets, the long hair. This is all just a way to make people move backwards, to basically not question the top secret technology that the government now is developing. One group has the technology, the weapons, the money, and the other group is growing marijuana. So it's very clever. And of course, in the sexual thing, this will probably lead back to Jan, but Huxley pointed out that if you're going to enslave a population, you need to really permit as much sexual activity as possible, because this is a release valve of the tension. So that's why you have the sexual drug, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This was the formula for slavery.
If I could make a point on that too, just the proliferation of, you know, I hate to say it, but internet pornography, you know, it's just everywhere.
Absolutely.
And it is so very much in the forefront of so many people's minds right now. You know, I mean, it's destroying relationships in a lot of ways, you know, and it's like promoting this, like, oh, it's not really cheating if it's online kind of a mentality. But in a way, you are, in my opinion, being deceitful and, I don't know, dishonest to your partner and to yourself, because, you know, you're giving your energy to something like that, and you're just allowing that visceral, what's the word I'm looking for? We're just saturated by it, you know, and it keeps us in this like desire mindset that we're just not gonna think about much else when something like that is right out there in front of us.
Pornography is the most destructive element to a culture since the British introduced opium into China.
I agree. Wow.
You know, and a few months ago, I did a show on Gnostic Media, and now I'm forgetting the gentleman's name whom I interviewed, but we had actually done a show recently on pornography and exposing all of that. Let me just see if I can find the episode here real quick. Looks like it's too far down. I think I interviewed him in December or November. But, you know, one thing that I wanted to add here so Joe just laid out all of these connections between Bateson and Bernays and everything. There's one other connection here. And Bernays and Gordon Wasson, again, they were friends for at least a decade. And we have Bernays discussing their friendship in a letter that I found at the U.S. Library of Congress. But, you know, all of these things, what they would do is they create these idols, whether it's drug idols like Terrence McKenna or Albert Hoffman or Timothy Leary, you know, all of these kind of guys, or whether it's music idols or movie stars. They literally create these things and then sell them to society, just like sex for the distraction. They're selling the idols to society. And Bernays said, human beings have need to have Godhead symbols, and public relations councils must help to create them. Okay, so, and then he goes on to say, we have no being in the air to watch over us. We must watch over ourselves, and that is where public relations counselors can prove their effectiveness by making the public believe that human gods are watching over us for our own benefit. Not that they really are watching over us for any benefit, but the, you know, just the perception that those people are there for our benefit.
Yes, on page 50 of Propaganda, this quote actually kind of encapsulates both your comments. He said, Bernays said, the group mind does not think in the strict sense of the word. In place of thoughts, it has impulses, habits, and emotions. In making up its mind, its first impulse is usually to follow the example of a quote-unquote trusted leader. This is one of the most firmly established principles of mass psychology. But when the example of the leader is not at hand, and the herd must think for itself, it does so by means of clichés, pat words, or images, which stand for a whole group of ideas and experiences. Men are rarely aware of the real reasons which motivate their actions. Men are largely activated by motives which they conceal from themselves.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the biggest thing that people need to look out for is this group mentality, this herd think, going to a large protest or a concert or anywhere that, where there's hundreds or thousands of people gathered together, the situation becomes far more vulnerable. And so people need to be on a far higher level of alert when they are in a large crowd situation.
Right. And I would also point out that, Frater, you'd mentioned the concept trust, and Bateson actually writes about this in terms of how to make black propaganda effective. There has to be trust. Now, this basically means that the false flag has to be effective. You have to have someone give you their trust so that you can tell them effectively a lie and have them believe it. This is really the principle that creates our entire media. All of these individuals that come in front of us, you know, have these devices to make us give them our trust. Sean Hannity sits and throws a football back and forth, you know, and of course, 80-90% of the news stories are innocuous and are just given so that you become conditioned into accepting information from a particular individual or network. But once the trust is created, now you are vulnerable, because now when they want to give you the critical concept, you know, an explanation of a false flag, typically, or lead you into a culturally destructive activity, like Life magazine's article about the psychedelic mushroom visions of Gordon Wasson. The problem is that you have given them the trust. And your mind, and that mechanically means your mind is vulnerable to what they say. In place of this, we really want to have skeptical citizens who use reason and are attached to their senses. This hopefully will be the outcome of all of our efforts, that we will have less trust and more reason skepticism.
Would you say that the show Mad Men is a characterization of the Bernays approach for people listening?
Yeah,
I mean, definitely.
Sure. I mean, it just normalizes propaganda.
Well, and not only that, but you see in the Mad Men series, and we've watched them all, but I think in season 5, they start promoting LSD and the whole bit right there, you know?
Yeah, that's really remarkable. I was really blown away by that, as a matter of fact. Now, Jan, I wanted to shift gears a little. You mentioned in those really awesome interviews you did with Dave McGowan, which are also available on Gnostic Media, you talked about the music of the generation of the 60s and how they've, you know, continually saturated our radio waves with it for the last 50 years. And you mentioned how it's like keeping us all in a time warp. And I really, really could relate to that. And I wonder if you could expound on that comment for us.
Well, I don't know if there's a whole lot to expound upon, but I mean, you know, anytime you turn on the radio or television today, you're pretty much bombarded. And it's funny because I hear myself in the video in Psychedelic Intelligence, we repeat me saying that little part over and over like 4 or 5 times. So it's like I'm saying, you know, they play the same songs over and over and over and over and over, and then I'm saying it over and over and over.
Yeah, it's true. And it's the same handful of songs most of the time.
Right, right. And either that or it's this new bubblegum pop music like Miley Cyrus and all this crap that's
don't
just
get me started,
you know,
it's on all Miley
it's
Cyrus.
All manufactured and then put out there, and you know, and they're dressed like whores and sluts to degrade society and to sell this crap to the kids and everything. So you have this whole, you know, Bernaysian mixture of sex and drugs and all of this stuff. And, you know, so then what they had to do with the drug aspect is, and this is something that I've been working on for a while. I've actually been working on this article, and I haven't really decided a firm name on it. And I think I sent it to you this morning, Frater. Did you have a chance to read that?
Yes, I did. And I found it fascinating how you it basically integrated Bernays's theories into this article of yours with regards to the way in which public relations changes labels in order to redirect the focus and the attention.
Right. Now, at the very beginning of that article, we cite a quote that originally we published, Joe and I published in the Manufacturing the Deadhead article from Health News, where they're talking about how Bernays promoted fluoride. And, you know, they would contact the dictionaries and encyclopedias and newspapers and give them the definitions. And then, you know, in the next publication, it would be followed up and defined in that exact way. So we see this exact same thing happening within the psychedelic movement. In fact, you know, we have there's a whole series of how psychedelics were relabeled, but their original name was psychotomimetic, which meant to mimic psychosis. And this was widely accepted by, you know, guys like Humphrey Osmond, who created the word psychedelic. In fact, in the Oxford English Dictionary, the third entry for the use of the word psychotomimetic is Humphrey Osmond. Now, Humphrey Osmond creates these other words. They then remarket them. You know, and Humphrey Osmond in the Oxford English Dictionary is quoted there as saying how perfectly fitting this term is. And so then when we switch a year later, maybe less than a year later, we see Osmond working with Huxley, and they're just, you know, so fraught over the idea of what to call these substances. And, you know, when you think about it, and today we know from MKUltra documents that Osmond was MKUltra, and it's all roads lead to Huxley when you're studying MKUltra. It's like, you know, Christianity, everything goes to Huxley. You cannot study anybody within the psychedelic community who promotes this crap that doesn't worship Huxley and literally put him out in the beginning of the book. So, you know, there's essentially this theme and this pattern where they lay all of this stuff down and then they sell it through the propaganda. So obviously, you know, a word like psychotomimetic or psychosis mimicking, it would not get the youth of America, you know, to run out and go jump
in. It doesn't roll off the tongue.
Yeah, you know, but if you remarket it to psychedelic, and there was another word, phanotheramine, something like that, that he created that was soul manifesting or something that fell on deaf ears. But they then create psychedelic, not psychodelic, because they didn't want it related with psycho. So the only word that's falsely put together from the Greek language is psychedelic. It's technically, it should be psychedelic, but they intentionally changed the O to an E. And then, let me just say, this is psychedelic means to manifest the mind. So then it goes from psychotomimetic, which means psychosis mimicking, to manifesting the mind. Okay. And then, in the video, as you know, Joe and I have kind of been piecing together this other article for a while that exposes all of this. But in the video, A Conversation on LSD, we see Aldous Huxley and Humphrey Osmond going to Harvard and Cambridge and hiring Leary to do this job. And like I said earlier, you know, we have Leary even admitting that the only thing that could stop him was the Bible. And Huxley is there in Leary's book Flashbacks telling Leary that, you know, you've just got to, you know, promote it, get it out there, do all of this stuff with it, you know, and we're supposed to believe that all this stuff is serendipitous, as Dave McGowan points out in his book. Whenever you know, something is just totally absurd and ridiculous with these intel guys and their stories, they use the words serendipitous or coincidence. So whenever you see those two words in these books, your head should, your ears should be burning. But so what they do then is these two guys, they go to Harvard in Cambridge City and they hire Leary to do this job. And then Leary goes out and he promotes psychedelics. And then, you know, and then they complain, oh, you know, the word psychedelic, it got ruined by Leary and it's no longer usable. And, you know, hallucinogen, it's a bad word and it's no longer usable. And by the way, those people that created the word hallucinogen and psychotomimetic, they had never even tried these substances. And this is what you actually see argued. So what they're arguing is that Humphrey Osmond, who created, who worked with Dr. Abram Hoffer, Dr. Abram Hoffer created the word hallucinogen. Abram Hoffer was one of the first people to try psychedelics, along with Huxley and Osmond, etc. And in fact, Osmond and Abram Hoffer wrote a book together called Hallucinogens. And so, or The Hallucinogens. So, you know, and after Leary popularizes them, they have to remarket psychedelics again. And that's where this part of the story that I was just mentioning fits in, because Wasson, Gordon Wasson, again, this CFR CIA agent, he comes along and he's working with Albert Hoffman, who quote unquote invented LSD, which that's another farce and that'll be exposed more soon. But so he's working together with Albert Hoffman, and then they join together with Professor Carl Ruck from Boston University, and they rename the psychedelics yet again to entheogens. And what does entheogen mean? This time it's not manifesting the mind. This time you're generating God within. And then these guys, along with Jonathan Odd and Jeremy Bigwood, they then attack the earlier guys who created the earlier words, which were Osmond and Hoffer, etc., their own team, and they pretend, oh, you know, those early guys, those military and CIA guys, they had never tried these substances. They didn't know what they were talking about. So we're suggesting that all of the earlier words are obsolete and out. Hallucinogen, psychedelic, psychotomimetic, all of them out. We have to use this new word, entheogen, that only promotes the idea that these substances were religious. And then when we go in and we see Gordon Wasson's work from Harvard on Maria Sabina and the Mazatec mushrooms, just in that one instance, he totally faked all of the information that Maria used them for religious purposes. She was very, very clear that the mushrooms were for healing purposes and for finding lost objects. And when asked about this, she said, "When I need to find God, I'm a good Catholic, I go to church." So all of that was left out. So anyway.
That's amazing. You know, I think that in your article, which you're still working on, that you sent me a rough draft of, one thing it reminded me of was from propaganda, where Bernays talked about after World War One, there had been an experience where they had named, like, I can't remember the exact words he used, it was like an emergency relief hospital that basically conjured expectations in the masses. When they were going there to be treated, they expected a certain treatment like you'd get at a hospital, which they weren't providing for the patients. So they were getting a lot of complaints. So the government wasn't meeting the needs of the folks. Then they changed the name to emergency center instead of emergency hospital. And all of a sudden, all the complaints stopped. It was the exact same principle of changing the name, repackaging it, representing it to the masses. You get a different reaction. I find it remarkable.
Well, let me just add, Frater, because, you know, after what they did was they had done these mind control tests in France in an area called Pont Saint-Esprit. Okay, and then this is what eventually leads to the famous Frank Olson murder that eventually exposes the MKUltra program. But my personal opinion of what happened was this big test that they did on this entire village of Pont Saint-Esprit in France, they saw that their application methods weren't very effective, using aerosol, putting it in the food, this and that, trying to get the people to take it. So they came up with an ingenious idea. What if they just remarketed them, and then they got the people to administer the drugs themselves.
Wow, it sounds familiar.
Well, let me give an example that I just find very amusing. If you look at Jim Morrison, all right, first of all, the Doors are taken from Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception. And then you look at his classic song, The End, with the Oedipal situation described, where the son is, you know, walking down and killing his father and then going and having sex with his mother. You can see that Morrison is, you know, looking at the same collection of thoughts and ideas that are coming from the Bernays and Freud world. There's nowhere else these ideas come from. He has Huxley's title, and then he is arrested while singing the song because he's miming masturbation, which of course is just repeating the Nijinsky act. So you get the entire cluster of you know, culturally negative activity, the drugs, obsession with sex and with sex out of the context of family. And then, of course, this is all from the son of Admiral Morrison, who was in charge of the false flag event at the Gulf of Tonkin. So you just couldn't have a better example of this, how a group takes these old concepts, the ones that they have developed, and remarkets them. So, as you know, you have Nijinsky in one hand, and then you have Jim Morrison in the next generation.
Yeah, and then some 25 years later, Joe, my wife and I attended a concert in Lawrence, Kansas, 25 years after Morrison was arrested for that miming masturbation. We attended a concert at a club with the group The Cramps, who, by the way, I think are from Florida. And the lead singer masturbated on stage openly in front of us. I was pretty shocked. I mean, he started to simulate sex with a speaker amp, and then he pulled his, privates right out on stage and was masturbating. It was just, I'm like, how?
Yeah, there was no miming.
There was no miming going on. He was blatantly doing this.
He was more modern.
Yeah, it's post-modern. Well,
and interestingly, you guys, gentlemen and lady, someone recently, a listener, had sent me all of this information that he had been investigating the punk scene, just like Dave McGowan had done in Laurel Canyon. And he had investigated the punk scene, and they all of them, nearly all of them, centered around Washington, D.C.
That concludes part one of our interview with Joe Atwill and Jan Ervin, CIA and the counterculture. Download part two for the conclusion. We hope you've enjoyed this thus far. Thanks for tuning in.